Gonna do some work for me out of the ranch. I looked at my boots, smiled, and looked up at Omar. The condensation from his breath had begun to freeze in his mustache. I'm going to need somebody to do some landscaping, Walt, and with the methane stuff, nobody wants to handle a mattock and a shovel around here anymore. I thought about it. You're not going to do that till June, right? He stepped in a little closer. Yeah, but I want to get somebody lined out to... You're not just trying to get Jules out of his community service, are you? Omar and Jules were cowboys, and the locals had their own mafia. No, no, no. I folded my arms and waited as Cesar Vittoria finished loading the prisoners and stood on the other side of the passenger door. The millionaire smoothed his mustache and wiped his gloves on his black jeans. All right, you got me. He took another breath. He's 74 years old, and you know what it means if he's doing his community service in May. He'll be out there shoveling every parking lot in town with that cheap plastic snow shovel he's got. Well, he was spry enough to try and climb out the bathroom window of the mint bar. He didn't make it. It wasn't for lack of trying. We stood there looking at each other, and I thawed a little, knowing the big game hunter was right. Throw Stu a letter and mention my name. Say, I said it'd be all right to suspend Jules's sentence till the end of May so that he can help you out at your place. He offered his hand, and I took it. Thanks, Walt. Keep him out of those bars in Sheridan. They aren't as forgiving as we are. I'll try. Omar mounted the steps, and I assisted Sancho in securing the ankle manacles on Hector, Shade, and Marcel Pop to the floor of the van. The three knew the drill and leaned forward as I made sure the chains going through the iron floor loops were secure and the padlock was shut. Next, I attached the handcuffs to the locks on the seat, but as I started to stand, Shade leaned forward and murmured in my ear, "Who will they send for you, Sheriff?" I stood up the rest of the way, my hand on the sliding door, as Cesar Vittoria started around to the driver's side. I inclined my head to get a clear look into the prisoner's eye. "Reno, you do know that anything you say to me is admissible evidence." "Yes, I understand that. But do you understand me?" His lips compressed, but he spoke through them, his powerful hands firmly clasped, his neck muscles bunched. "They have spoken to me since the first one, which is how I knew my mission was the only way to stop them." I started to slide the door closed. "Uh-huh." His voice stopped me. "Do you think you're a good man, Sheriff?" I wasn't quite sure what to say to that, especially within context, so I just nodded and fell back on the lessons my mother had taught me. "I hope so." He grew still, and his eyes looked like nails driven into his face. I stood there studying him for a second. "Don't test me again." "But I will, Sheriff. I will." He continued to look at me with the one eye, and his breath traced across a corner of his mouth like a wisp of smoke escaping from a kettle. I closed the door. Normally I drove, but the Basco got bored riding, so I had given him the option when we'd left Durant, and he'd taken it. As I got in the passenger side, I remembered I'd put Shade's stolen blade in my pocket. Sancho started the used van and glanced at me. "Route 422 toward Baby Wagon?" I pulled the errant steak knife from my jeans and threw it onto the dash. "Yep." The Basco, more than a little curious, looked at the knife and then me. I pointed toward the road ahead. "Good thing this piece of crap is full-time two-wheel drive." 20 miles down the road, there was a gravel cutoff that led to the right and a slight upgrade. There were two black Chevy Suburbans with government plates, what looked to be about a half dozen feds, a heavily armored Ameritrans van with two men seated inside, one uniformed man on the outside, a Bighorn County Sheriff's Department truck, and another from Washakie County. It was a regular cop convention. Sancho wheeled the van in among the parked vehicles next to the large cluster of men. Before I could get my seatbelt off, Joseph Ironcloud, the Arapaho sheriff of Washakie County, banged on my door. Hey, we got too many cops out here. You got any bad guys in there?" Joe was newly elected in the county west of us. a handsome veteran from the First Gulf War. He had model good looks, only slightly reduced by a scar that ran from the corner of his mouth to his hairline. He was about size of Vittoria's age, and cut quite a swath at the Wyoming Sheriff's Association meetings. He hung a couple of fingers on the handle as I cracked the door open. "We got three. Is that going to be enough?" He grinned, revealing the small space between his two front teeth as he kicked his chewing gum to the other side of his mouth. "I don't know. How bad are they?" I buttoned my sheepskin jacket and flipped up my collar. "Pretty bad." Sancho joined us at the door and shook hands with Joe. They were a lot alike, and I had a feeling I was getting a glimpse of the future of Wyoming law enforcement. Sizer Vittoria gripped Iron Cloud's shoulder in his gloved hand as Troy Old Man, another Arapaho, and one of Joe's deputies joined us. Sancho smiled. "Jesus, Indians!" Joe nodded in faux seriousness. He was still working his gum. "Yeah, they brought us in to counterbalance the influx of ETA terrorists from the other side of the mountain." He turned the grin on me. "Hey, how come you didn't bring that other deputy, the good-looking one?" Joe was smitten by my under-sheriff, Vic. "I left the women folk behind. We heard they were Indians." The three younger men followed me over to the larger group that leaned against one of the Suburbans as Joe continued to have fun introducing us to the assembled manpower. I stuck a hand out to Tommy Wayman, who was Rosie's cousin and the sheriff of Bighorn County, as Joe kept talking. "You guys know Grumpy?" Vic had tagged him with the nickname, and everyone used it, but only she and Joe used it to his face. Wayman shook my hand, but his heart wasn't in it. "Walt?" I'd heard that he had planned to retire last cycle, but then I'd also heard that about myself. He was a rough cob, and most of the state didn't care for his my-way-or-the-highway style of management, but he was one of the few sheriffs as old as I was, so I liked keeping him around, if for nothing more than comparative purposes. "Tommy?" I shook hands with Wayman's deputy, but his name escaped me in the gusts of wind. I figured it didn't matter since we would be parting company soon. The next couple of individuals were probably the reason for the sheriff of Bighorn County's bad mood. They were feds, and a number of years back Tommy had accidentally become a national figure when he'd challenged in court the rights of federal agents to operate within the confines of his county without proper authorization from him. It must have been a pretty important deal for these two organizations to come together, and I had a feeling it had to do with our proximity to the Bighorn National Forest. A crew-cut man in Ray-Bans and black, insulated coveralls extended his hand. "Special Agent in charge, Mike McGroder, Salt Lake Division." I nodded as a few more gusts buffeted against us. "Enjoying the weather? I hear this is classified as a fine spring afternoon in Wyoming." He turned to the young woman standing beside him. "This is Special Agent Fife out of D.C. The lean blonde with the athletic build and direct chambray-colored eyes shook my hand and then sized the Vittoria's. "And Tom Benton from the Federal Marshal's office in Denver." Benton was a tall redhead with a black ball cap to match his own noir ensemble, including the tactical shotgun slung to his chest. He smiled, but only as a professional courtesy. "Hello?"
"Howdy."
There were a few other men in coveralls who were holding close-range weapons and who approached and shook hands, introducing themselves as Marshal John Mooney and Agent Bob Belmont. There were three more men in the transport company's uniforms, but I supposed they weren't worthy of introduction. I glanced at the two individuals in the back of the Ameritrans van just to make sure they were indeed prisoners. One was studying his hands and rocking back and forth with more energy than remaining seated and manacled would allow. The other man pasted his nose against the back window like a child. He had long hair that covered most of his face, but unlike his friend, he had taken the time to stare at us newcomers. "You know, there's got to be a reason why all the good guys are standing out here in the cold and all the bad guys are in the vans with the heaters running." McGroder smiled. "You'd think, wouldn't you?" He folded his arms over his chest, and I wondered at the perfection of his government-issue close-cropped crew-cut. With no cap, it must have been a little breezy for the current temperature. "Sheriff, do you mind if we transfer two of your prisoners and talk with the other?"
"Be my guest."
I nodded at Sizer Vittoria and handed him the keys to the prisoner's shackles, and watched as he, two of the armed federal men, two of the Ameritrans men, and Troy Old Man headed over. Do you really want to talk to him in our van? Mirgoda looked at Pfaff, and she was the one to speak.
Yes, but I'll wait till the other two have been transferred so that I can speak with him alone.
I looked at the assembled group. It's your party. Mirgoda glanced at Tommy Wayman and then back at me. Thank you, Sheriff. We stood there a few minutes more and then watched as Marcel Popp and Hector Otero were switched into the Ameritrans van. Once this was accomplished, the Salt Lake agent nodded and moved toward the vehicle with Pfaff and Benton in tow. Sizer Pretoria passed them on the way, but they said nothing to him. We local boys stood there and looked at each other, none of us aware of what the others knew. I didn't know much of anything other than what was in the reports I'd read, so I asked, "What the heck is going on?" Tommy sighed. "Oh, the usual horseshit." Joe laughed and stared at his insulated boots, making patterned footsteps in the compacted snow with short, fancy dance steps. "They haven't told us anything, Walt. I guess we're just the transport."
"Three counties worth?"
The Arapaho spit his gum out into a wrapper and tucked it into his coat pocket.
"Yeah, but I gotta tell you that knowing what I know about this Shade fella, I'd just as soon drag him out, shoot him in the head, and charge the feds for my time and ammo."
I glanced at the agents in the van and the three standing between the two vehicles. "Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but within a half mile of this location we can be in Bighorn, Washakie, and Absaroka counties, not to mention the National Forest. Oh, it's got to be a jurisdictional deal. It's just that they don't know where they are or what the hell they're doing, per usual." Tommy sighed deeply again. Joe's dark eyes shifted, and his edgy features reminded me of my buddy Northern Cheyenne Henry Standing Bear. Tonight he and I were going to discuss the planning of my daughter's wedding to Michael, who was Vic's younger brother. Katie wanted to have the ceremony performed up on the res this summer, and the Cheyenne Nation was my go-to guy. Joe's voice broke up my thoughts as we all turned toward the van.
"Maybe that's what they're finding out."
We were about to adjourn the meeting and climb in somebody's vehicle when Mirgoda and Pfaff exited, leaving Benton seated behind Shade. The Salt Lake City agent immediately approached Joe.
"Thank you, Sheriff Ironcloud. We won't be needing you."
Joe kicked his face sideways with a grin.
"Excuse me?"
Mirgoda repeated himself. Ironcloud stood there for a minute more, then shrugged and turned toward the rest of us.
"Hey, hey, must be north of here, boys. But then again, these federal agents have a long-standing dislike of us Indians since Pine Ridge."
Knowing better than to hang around when he wasn't needed, Joe shook all hands and started off toward his vehicle with his deputy. As he passed Sizer Pretoria, he pulled out a pack of gum and offered the Basco a piece, which he took. Joe spoke in my deputy's ear. Sancho laughed and then unwrapped the gum, stuffed it in his mouth, and began chewing. Mirgoda stuck his hands in his coveralls as the Washakie County truck pulled away and then considered me.
"I'm sorry, Sheriff Longmire." "It's Longmire, right?"
"Yep." He continued to study me like a multiple-choice question.
"You'll have to come with us, Sheriff. It appears that our plans have changed."
It was a short distance on a snow-covered gravel road until we reached the corrals at the junction of 422 and the spur of 419 that straddled the line between Tommy Wayman's county and mine. Both portions were overlapped by the Bighorn National Forest. Renault Shade sat in the middle seat of our van with Mirgoda on one side, Pfaff on the other, Benton still behind him. The agents were talking in low voices as Sizer Pretoria drove. When we got to the corner, the prisoner spoke, "Here." The Basco slowed and even went so far as to put on his turn signal for the Suburban that followed us. The other federal vehicles and the Ameritrans transport with Otero and Pop had gone ahead to Meadowlark Lodge. Pfaff was talking to Renault Shade with the familiarity that a doctor had with a patient.
"You're sure? It was a while ago."
I could see the reflection of his one eye getting the lay of the land.
"I'm sure."
The road got bumpier as we left the loop and headed north toward Baby Wagon Creek. We got to a turn where I'd remembered a Basque sheep wagon being parked during a fly-fishing trip with Henry and the Ferg. It was going to get a lot rougher from here on in, and I was relieved when Shade spoke again. "Here." Sizer Pretoria eased the van to a stop, and it shifted a little down the incline toward the creek. I turned in my seat.
Agent Pfaff stared to the side of the prisoner's face, and Magruder, holding a plastic-sealed quad sheet for comparison, read the LED display on a handheld global tracking device. "It's within 100 yards of where he said." Shade looked past me through the windshield. "We can walk from here." I turned to look up the creek bed and could see a number of rock outcroppings sticking up through the snow before the dark shadows of the fir trees blocked everything out. It was getting late, and up this high the shadows were long. We unlocked Shade from the floor, threw a blanket over him, and he walked with one of the feds on either side. Pfaff followed, and Magruder, Sizer Pretoria, Sheriff Wayman, Marshal Benton, and another of the field agents pulled up the drags. Magruder continued to read the GPS with the assistance of the map, but surprised me by speaking as we trudged through the snow. "So, did he say anything while he was in your custody, Sheriff?" I thought about the things Shade had uttered over the last day, most of it indiscernible. "He said that two men had sent him a bone in the mail about wanting the money." The agent's eyes slipped up to mine. "Is that all he said?" I thought about it some more. "He also said something about voices and testing me, but I think that was mostly guff." Magruder nodded. Up ahead, Shade turned, the heavy wool blanket forming a makeshift hood that shadowed his dark face, and, like a malevolent monk, he looked directly at me. "Here." The group assembled on a slab of moss rock about the size of a door. "I buried him here." Magruder checked the GPS one last time and looked at his map before turning to look at Tommy. "Thank you for your help, Sheriff Wayman. I'll have one of my men drive you back down to your vehicle." He turned to me. "Not your lucky day, Longmire." Chapter 3. The temperature had shifted to slightly above 40 degrees, and the booming in the distant dark clouds promised a freezing rain if we weren't lucky. We continued to watch as the younger agents and Sizer Pretoria, under the attentive eye of Special Agent Pfaff, excavated the snow from around the boulder. Magruder and I were too old for that kind of foolishness, and were sharing a thermos of really good coffee in the cab of one of the Suburbans. "And those are the two other convicts who were in the Ameritrans van?"
"Yes."
He blew into his stainless travel mug. Even it was black. "I'm sorry about all the cloak and dagger stuff, but we're on a need-to-know basis, and until I could verify which county we were dealing with, I had to keep my cards close to the vest." I nodded. He drank from his mug. "I was just as happy to not have it be Sheriff Ironcloud's jurisdiction."
"Because?"
"The victim is Native American." I looked at him as he continued to sip his coffee. "Crow, to be exact. Taken from a vehicle parked at a bar bait shop near Hardin, Montana."
"Shade ID'd the victim, even though the child was never reported missing."
There was a long pause, and while I thought that one over, I heard a few frigid drops of sleet, sounding like pebbles, hit the top of the Chevrolet. I gestured toward the other Suburban.
"And those two?"
"Just your garden-variety psychotic scumbags. Calvin Fingers Moser is the one with the string of hair, and Freddy Junk Food Junkie Borland is the one who can't keep still. A couple of fun-loving drug abusers from Arizona who like to get high, kill people, and then sell the body parts."
"Charming."
"Isn't it, though? Through Shade, they had a medical connection in Mexico, to which they gave a running supply of kidneys, livers, lungs, hearts, and eyes. Years back, on some PCP-induced binge, they killed an elderly couple near Sedona and buried their bodies out in the desert. Borland was working at a livestock dismemberment plant when Shade turned them on to the guys in Central America. They pretty much drove around killing people and selling the parts."
He sipped his coffee some more and then waxed financial.
"You can get $40,000 to $50,000 for a healthy kidney on the open market. Some guy had one for sale on eBay."
I interrupted, mostly so that I wouldn't have to hear more.
"Is that your specialty? Organ trafficking?"
"No."
We continued to watch as the working class finished shoveling around the boulder, and we were faced with the eventuality of getting out of the SUV. "Pfaff's a specialist, psychotic schizophrenia, and Ray No Shade is the textbook for psy-skits. No Shade's first American homicide was this Native American child abduction across state lines. Then there's the supposed missing $1.4 million. He grew silent, but finally spoke again. You pull up the file?
Only part of it. What I did read sounds like a horror movie.
He finished off his coffee and placed the travel mug back in the holder. That it does. I swallowed the rest from my thermos top and did the same, closing the doors behind us and tromping across the trampled snow to where the crew was working. They had produced a pry bar, were laboring around the edges of the rock to unfreeze it from its surroundings, and had connected a tow strap to the back of one of the Suburbans as well. There was a nudging sound, and with one more spot of leverage, the boulder broke free and shifted a few inches. "That's enough." McGroder produced a mag light from his breast pocket, and, shining the beam behind the rock, slipped between the other men. "Difficult to see. We're going to have to move it further." A large man in one of the tactical uniforms moved to one side of the rock, while another went to the opposite side. They braced themselves and heaved mightily as the tires of the Suburban spun and the distant thunder echoed off the surrounding peaks. Nothing happened. With a quick estimation, I figured the boulder weighed close to 5,000 pounds. They tried again, but with the same results. I glanced at McGroder. Shade supposedly moved this by himself? I spoke to the nearest agent. Climb up on top and push with your legs, and I'll try this side. I stepped past the Fed on the left, planted a foot against the embankment, and worked my hands behind the cold surface of the rock as the agent braced his boots against it. On three.
1, 2, 3.
Same result. I looked up at McGroder's arched eyebrow. Well, even Atlas shrugged. I worked my hands in deeper than before, and on the count of three the rock shifted and revealed its egg-like shape, with the more narrow portion being the part we'd been pushing on. We hadn't so much moved the boulder as repositioned it, and if we were planning on doing any more, we were going to have to break out a hydraulic jack and pray we got it done before the sleet began in earnest. McGroder leaned over the boulder with a flashlight. That's all we need for now.
They mailed him part of the jawbone in prison to get him to tell them where the money was?
McGroder looked out at what would have been the panoramic view from Meadowlark Lodge as the sleet pounded the plate glass windows. Shade had given the boy's bone to them, who knows why, maybe as a gift, maybe as a warning, but Moser and Borland still wanted their part of the $1.4 million the three of them had supposedly extorted from the organ donor business. The bone arrived in a brown paper wrapper at the Draper, Utah prison, where Shade was being housed, with a post office box return address in Bisbee, Arizona. That's where we apprehended the two. These guys are not exactly destined for Mensa. The agent mentioned Shade's residence in Draper like the killer was renting an apartment rather than being housed in the maximum security prison for only the most violent and escape-prone prisoners in the country.
What was his name?
Oh, the boy. He said it was Owen White Buffalo.
There are moments in your life when you hear that first click of the dominoes, and you know that whatever happens from that point, it's all going to be bad.
I sat there in that moment, listening to the noises inside me. My heart, the blood surging through my veins, the unwanted adrenaline that was now causing my hands to grow still and my face to become cool.
Jesus, Sheriff, I haven't seen a response like that in quite a while. You knew this kid?
My mouth was dry, and I suddenly wanted more coffee.
No, but I know the family, and up until now I thought I was conversant with all their miseries.
I fought the weight in my chest by asking more questions, unsure if I was going to like the answers.
From what you've told me, it doesn't fit Moser and Borland's M.O. Can you even take organs from a child that young for transplant purposes?
The boy was before they partnered. That's why the other two are so quick to give Shade up. They had nothing to do with this one. Personally, I don't think there is any money, but it got the other two to surface, and that's good enough for me. We were just going to use Shade to find the body, but I needed confirmation, and that's where the other two come in.
The conversation we were having was only made worse by the immediate surroundings.
The lodge at Meadowlark Lake had been closed for a couple of years, and Holly and Wayne had not planned on renovating it until they finished with South Fork and Deerhaven, which was a couple of miles west. We sat in the empty cafe and listened to the coolers cooling nothing, and the sleet hissing on the tin roof, an accompanying wind skiff kicking up snow devils across the icy surface of the lake. By all rights, it was spring, but every year somebody forgot to tell the mountains. Most of the FBI agents, except Magruder, were still at Baby Wagon Creek. The agent and I had elected to retreat to Meadowlark in the wake of the prisoners. Renault's something of an opportunist. You noticed his eye? I tried to focus on something other than the name White Buffalo and watched the lightning strike in chains across the big lake. I did. Plucked it out himself. I wasn't quite sure what to say to that, and was saved by a melodramatic clap of thunder. During the stint in Draper, there was an altercation between Shade and another prisoner over a female correspondent. I still wished we had more of the good coffee, but supplies were slow coming from South Fork Lodge, where we'd had lunch. My stomach gnawed on itself, reminding me that it was coming up on 6 o'clock at night. It was a Friday, which also reminded me that I hadn't called to cancel dinner with Vic and Henry. Shade killed him? Yeah. Renault had a postal affair going on with the woman, and this other guy made some remarks which cost him his life. Carved him up with a homemade knife, but at the time it appeared as if he'd lost an eye in the fight, which got him sent to the medical unit where he escaped. They consequently discovered that he'd plucked the eye out himself and cut it loose with the same shank. Shows a specific type of determination, doesn't it? I looked out the window to see Sizer Vittorio rushing by the parked but still running vehicles with a couple of sacks containing what I assumed was the first round of supplies from South Fork Lodge. I wasn't sure if I was still hungry. My eyes stalled on the fogged windshield of our borrowed Wyoming Department of Correction van, where Renault Shade sat chained in the center, with Marshal Benton sitting behind him and another marshal seated in the driver's seat. The other prisoners, all four of them, were awaiting departure in the Ameritrans van under the careful eye of yet another marshal and the three Ameritrans employees. The Basco booted open the front door of the lodge with his foot. He glanced back to where Beatrice was pulling more bags from the passenger seat of her blazer, which she had parked under the overhang of the building. "We've got more, but I'm not sure how you want to feed the prisoners." Magruder, a little daunted by the deluge outside, stood and picked up his satellite phone from the table. "In the vans and locked down. I'll go get things coordinated with my guys." He paused as Sancho pulled out a waxed paper-wrapped club sandwich. "Save one of those for me, will you?" The Basco smiled and pulled out two more. "You bet." Beatrice entered with more bags and rested them on the table. "Boy, the roads are bad from the lodge to here. This is the last of it." She glanced at me. "Are you paying, Sheriff?" I gestured toward Magruder. "The federal government will be picking up the tab this time." The Fed took the receipt from the woman,